Hello everyone and welcome to this week's episode of Boat Briefing. We're doing things a little bit differently this week because we are bringing you one of the talks from the Explorer Yacht Summit, which we ran in November in Monaco. Sophia, why don't you tell us about which one we're listening to today?
Yeah, so in today's podcast, we're bringing you the Leave No Trace panel, where I was joined on stage by Ashley Perrin, the owner of Antarctic Ice Pilot, Mark Duncan, Director of Marketing and Business Development at Fraser Yachts, Captain Malcolm Jacquetine, the founder of 360 Marine, and Rosie O'Donnell, Coordinator and Administrator of Yachts of Science. During this panel, we tried to discuss the difficult balance between wanting to explore these remarkable environments while also ensuring that they're protected for future generations. We discussed some of the kind of practical steps that can be done to reduce impact and what percentage of owners are actually prepared to take on these changes. We also looked at how yachts can be proactive when they're visiting these destinations, for example, getting involved with scientific research, and specifically how Yachts for Science can help owners get involved. It's a really interesting discussion, so we hope you enjoy.
While the chairs come on, I'll introduce our next guest. You know, if the last 2 weeks in Glasgow has highlighted anything, it's in part how much of a clown the British Prime Minister, who was the host, is, but perhaps more crucially, of course, the reality of how fragile our world is, how much we all need to think about our actions, our footprint, and collaborative design, innovation, implementation are really crucial to the success of that. In this next session, Sophia will explore how we balance our growing desire to visit remote parts of the world, often with fragile ecosystems, and still ensure they are preserved for future generations. She has with her an absolute stellar lineup of guests. Please welcome Sophia, Ashley Perrin, Mark Duncan, Captain Malcolm Jacquetine, and Rosie O'Donnell. Thank you.
Thank you so much all for joining me today. To start with, I'll just introduce you again just to give you a little bit more background. So Mark is Director of Marketing and Business Development at Fraser. He's been in the industry for more than two decades now and very familiar to most of you, I'm sure. He's a proud member of Fraser's Green Team, which aims to help protect and preserve the environment and reduce the footprint of Fraser's clients, partners and staff. Ashley Perrin had a successful career as a professional racing sailor, which might explain the current sling situation, and in 2009 took the decision to join the British Antarctic Survey and spent 3 years living and working in Antarctica, and even got married down there in the end. She's now a qualified ice pilot and specialises in taking super yachts to the region. Next, Captain Malcolm Jacquetine has spent more than 30 years as a yacht captain on vessels ranging from a 57 Swan to 164 metre Eclipse, so quite the portfolio behind him. He's the founder of 360 Marine and is passionate about finding a more sustainable future for yachting. And lastly, it's my pleasure to be joined by Rosie, who is the coordinator of Yachts for Science. As Rob referred to them earlier, it's the Tinder for super yacht owners and scientific projects. The idea being that it helps link owners that want to use their yachts for good with scientists that are looking for projects across the world. Ashley, I might start with you. There's been a lot of talk today about Antarctica and, you know, the increased interest down there. Have you seen firsthand boat traffic increasing, and are you seeing an impact of that down there?
Yeah, so I've got my little note here so that I don't get it wrong. But yeah, in the last 10 years, so since 2009 we had 37,000 people on the peninsula on 47 different distinct vessels. And in 2019, we had 74,000 people on 62 distinct vessels. So definitely a large increase. And that's in really a 250 nautical mile by 150 nautical mile area. So quite a small area to put all those vessels and people. Individual expeditions basically have to, in order to get a permit, they have to mitigate their environmental impact to no more than a minor or transitory, an intangible level. If they don't do that, then they won't get permit to go down there. So the issue is really the cumulative impact, and that's what we don't really know. And that's why IATO, International Anchored Tourism Operators, Association of Tourism Operators, is doing working groups to manage for this growth, because the cumulative impact isn't really known.
And without wishing to put you on the spot early doors in this panel, we can probably take a guess that the cumulative impact is not going to be a positive one. If that's the case, how do you think we can continue to justify to take yachts there, and super yachts there in particular, that are, you know, you're taking a small number of guests on a relatively impactful vessel, potentially?
Well, I think I go back to what Rob started this whole thing with. You know, if you lead a safe expedition, that's got responsible and robust environmental practices at the core of the expedition, your guests return with a greater understanding, and you create an ambassador for the region. People aren't willing, are unlikely to protect an environment that they've never been in. Hmm. So you have to take them to it for them to understand it. And creating an Antarctic ambassador, a high net worth individual, is pretty important. Because it's a continent at the bottom of the world that not many people know much about.
And Captain Malcolm, you've been on a variety of vessels. What are some of the really basic things that owners or charters, for that matter, should be thinking about putting in place to reduce the impact?
I think in terms of the existing fleet, there's a number of practical steps that one can take to, first of all, reduce the amount of fuel that you use, which has a benefit in using in emitting CO2. And, for example, there's the relationship between speed and power is not linear. So, for example, just a small reduction in speed, say 10%, can equate to a 30% saving in fuel consumption. So a lot of these yachts are going on long passages to reach their destination. So if you're willing to accept a slightly longer time to take, then you can reduce that impact on from the fuel itself. And then, of course, there's the above and below the water emissions from waste and garbage, and that's possibly the more challenging things when you go to these more remote locations, because there clearly isn't the facilities ashore to receive them, and of course they can have quite a detrimental environmental impact. So minimizing waste is a key thing to do on board. So when you're provisioning, when you're taking stores on board before you set off, then remove the packaging. Avoid taking plastic on board. Try to avoid the use of bottled water, fit water dispensing systems on board. Try to use eco-certified chemicals throughout the boat, so that, again, they're not having an impact on the environment. So there's lots of practical steps that one can take now to try and minimise and mitigate any environmental impact from the use of the yacht.
Mark, some of these practical steps do then have a kind of knock-on impact for the owner, potentially. It requires them making at least some change, maybe potentially going as far as making a bit of a sacrifice in terms of comfort. From your experience, do you think clients are at a stage now where they're prepared to make these changes, or do you think there's still a reluctance?
I think not all clients are the same, obviously. I think there are increasingly so now more clients that are more interested in taking more note about what they should and can do in the operations of their yachts. Are all clients like that? No. There are still plenty of clients that don't even believe global warming exists. But, you know, that's our world, right? I mean, that's not just ultra-high net worth individuals. That's everyone in the world. So, but I think there's an increasing number and that are taking note of the fact that, yes, there are things we can do. There are things we should do. And actually, things may be looking like things aren't going quite right with the environment, so we should play our part in that. And when you have things like that wonderful Oxfam report that came out recently, you know, that type of sort of soft pressure in the background, COP26 and various other things that are going to be coming up, are all building up to tell one particularly convincing narrative, and that is we've all got to do something whether we're an ultra high net worth or not. I mean, one of the big things that you hear about a lot is from shipyards, from us brokers and various other members of our industry is there's an extra cost to it. You made a brilliant point this morning, Malcolm, where you were noting that, you know, for every ton of fuel used, it's 3.2 tons of carbon emissions. That's well known. I mean, and there's a way to fix that. As you mentioned, one solution is biofuels, you know, and you can get it right down to 5%. You know, I mean, there's a huge reduction, but there's a cost. But just to remind us all, you know, we're not in an industry which is built on some sort of logic about cost, right? I mean, the whole fundamentals of luxury yachting is not based on some sort of coherent economic financial concept about making money or saving money. You know, we spend millions on boats that are going to cost us 5 to 10% every year to run. And then when we come to sell them, we're going to end up maybe getting between 40 and 70% of the price that we actually bought it for. That makes no economic sense. So the whole thing about cost being a barrier, I don't believe is an issue. I think cost is not a barrier to getting into yachting. And the reason why cost is not a barrier to getting into yachting is because the perceived benefit of yachting is way higher than the cost of getting in. And that's the secret to everything we do in life is the benefit greater to us than the cost. You know, there's that old saying that long after you've forgotten how much you paid for something, you're still enjoying the benefits. So given that, as somebody said this morning, given that we are an industry that is placed in a unique position of being able to influence some of the greatest potential ambassadors for this planet that exist today, and that's influence that can be applied by shipyards, by engineers, by architects, designers, and brokers. The influence I think that we can have in our industry is to show the benefit of the cost of being more sustainable. And, you know, I mean, my job is to take care of marketing, take care of business development. And that's interesting because there's two parts to this. One is the messaging, getting the messaging across to owners, potential owners, about the benefit of doing things on your yacht, no matter how small, but doing things on your yacht or your new yacht that are going to be sustainable. But secondly is the business perspective. I mean, if you think that today the sustainability of a yacht is being talked about and is an issue, in 5-10 years' time, that's going to be a thousandfold. Now, if I own a yacht that is in no way sustainable or paying some sort of lip service to this, I'm going to have one heck of a hard time selling that boat in 5-10 years' time. And if I do manage to sell that boat in 5-10 years' time, it's going to be for an amount of money that's going to make me and generations of my family cry. So, you know, there's a real business incentive today, now, to make that difference. As Malcolm has said, there's a wealth of material online. There's a lot of things that we can all do in terms, all the way from fuel consumption, the quality of our engines, the materials that we build our boats with, how we use our boats, where we take our boats, what the crew are doing on board, all of that. There's so much we can do today. Yeah, and I think the business will drive that.
That's clearly one side of the puzzle, is kind of that reduction side and making the boats, reducing impact. The other is potentially the positive work that we can maybe do when we visit these environments. And that's where hopefully Yachts for Science comes in. Rosie, I've given it a bit of a crude introduction, but could you maybe explain in a bit more detail how Yachts for Science works and what it aims to do?
Yachts for Science is basically a sort of, as we said before, a dating agency between marine biologists and boats that would like to have marine biologists on board. So we created a database of really first-class leading marine biologists of the world who their biggest problem is getting access to boats. So they will apply 100 times for an application for a grant. Then they get their grant approved, and then they still can't get on the water to do their marine biology. So this is a great opportunity for somebody to take with them with their family on board, or with the owners on board. Owner doesn't even need to be on board for 2 to 4 weeks, 4 to 6 marine biologists, and use that time to have a really purposeful, meaningful holiday with a marine biologist on board.
And Ashley, I know you were on the only trip that went to Antarctica last year during the COVID, and that was partly because of the research that needed to be undertaken. What was that project, and why was it so important that it happened, you know, even when there weren't other yachts visiting down there?
Yeah, so I was really lucky because I was transported back in time to before I was born in Antarctica. In that, we went down and there was no footprints. There was nobody. There was no ship scheduler to worry about. There was no wilderness etiquette to abide by because we were the only people down there. And I was also very lucky in that the principal didn't turn up for 14 days. And so we were down there for 14 days and I had a 91 meter and a 67 meter to wander around the Antarctic Peninsula. And as a result, we did some great science. I'd say that we didn't necessarily get the permitting because of the science, but we, at the end of the day, the UK government and the Australian government went to the Chilean government and said, this expedition needs to happen because they have Dr. Tom Hart, who calls himself a penguinologist, on board. And what he does is he has 100 different camera locations all around the peninsula. And these cameras take time-lapse pictures. And they're pretty crude in that they're just a wildlife game camera. And you have to collect the SD card out of them to get the data. It's not satellite linked. And you have to change the batteries out. So the lithium batteries have to be changed out. So this means that somebody has to get into a Zodiac and climb up a hill to wherever the penguins... I mean, penguins, they get like 200, 300 meters up a cliff. They're pretty amazing in how far they go. And then somebody has to find that the camera is fallen in a lot of penguin guano. and you have to wash off the camera and get the SD card out. So... basically, that's what we're doing is getting this time-lapse data. And why is that important? Because there's three things that are affecting penguins. One is climate change, the other is fishing, and the other is potentially tourism. So the competent authorities want to know, is the decrease in penguin populations due to tourism, fishing, or climate change, or a mixture of all of that? So Tom had this ideal opportunity that will never happen again, where we went from 74,000 people on the peninsula to 6 people on the peninsula as tourists. And who gets that as a scientist, where you get to take away one of the impacts on your project? So it became very important to get that because the batteries would have run out and the SD cards would have got full up.
And Rosie, what are some of the projects that Yacht for Science is currently looking to match up?
So Dr. Michelle Taylor, she is a leading marine biologist in coral. She calls herself a coral nerd. She's been studying coral reefs for 15 years, and she simply wants to have a boat in April in the Northern Caribbean for 4 to 6 marine biologists to come out from the University of Essex. They've got a ROV 3D imaging camera that goes down to 200 meters, and they want to photograph the twilight zones of the coral reefs in the Northern Caribbean. So over the Easter holidays, for somebody who was there with their family, they could be on board for a week. They could then stay for a further 3 weeks. It sounds like an amazing no-brainer to me, but then I work with these guys all the time, and they're just such lovely people. They're all teachers. They're all leading lecturers in their own right, and they all want to share their knowledge. So the other one we have is Dr. Guy Stevens, from the CEO and founder of the Manta Ray Trust, and he's looking for 2 to 3 weeks in the Maldives in the first quarter of the 2022, because the giant oceanic manta rays, they come in and they come to some of these sort of more lesser known atolls, and they only are there for 3 or 4 weeks, and then they're gone again. And he's been studying manta rays there for 17 years. And you could have a week swimming with giant oceanic manta rays and studying them with him.
Mark, are you starting to see owners or charterers kind of come and start to be more open to this idea of maybe including some scientific research with their holiday, and that it actually might be an addition rather than a, you know, a sacrifice?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. I mean, we love what you guys do. It's fantastic. I mean, you know, we have a number of our owners who are doing a number of different things to help science, to provide data that allows a bigger picture, better picture to work out what's going on with the oceans or plastic in the oceans and all sorts of stuff. So yeah, definitely seeing a lot more of that. The whole notion of carbon offsetting was mentioned earlier on. Carbon offsetting could be a trap if you see it as being, hey, I just need to do that and carry on doing what I'm doing. But, you know, still, it's better than nothing, I guess. So carbon offsetting is quite a big thing. In fact, you know, we now include that on, I don't know exactly who's in the industry here, but whenever you do a charter, you normally fill out a form that's called a preference sheet that allows a charter guest to say what they want on their boat and what sort of food they want and all that. So we now include that. We now say, would you like to offset your charter? We ask questions like, rather than having your laundry done every single day, are you happy to do it on a need-to-do basis? You know, we can introduce, it comes back to that notion of influencing. It introduces ideas that maybe charterers hadn't thought of before, which all goes to help in a little bit. But to your point, Sophia, and we're noticing it especially with charterers, because charterers now, especially the younger generation, the guys before were talking about, you know, a new generation coming in. And it should be said, I mean, that 40%, more than 40% of clients in charter and in the sales that were done this year are brand new to yachting. Never done it before. First time people coming in, new blood. And it's these guys that are coming in and asking the questions, look, when you do a selection of boats that are available for charter from me, could you just let me know what are the green or sustainable qualities for these boats? Because it might help me decide which one to go for.
And Malcolm, hopefully looking even further ahead with those new clients that are coming into the industry, are there any new technologies that you think might dramatically help to reduce a yacht's impact, you know, in the future, looking down the line? Are there things that we should be excited about?
I think we should be terribly excited and optimistic about some of the solutions that are in development and many of which are maturing. I mean, just on the waste and garbage side, you know, we now have, for example, advanced wastewater treatment plants that treat both sewage and the grey water. Because in the past, you know, sewage was treated, but the grey water tended to be discharged straight into the ocean without any treatment. And for those who have been fortunate enough to lift off the lid of a grey water tank, it's probably more pungent than a sewage tank. And in fact, the content of that, when you can imagine it's coming from showers, it's coming from sinks, it's coming from galleys, it's coming from the laundry. It's full of organic matter that is just brewing away in the bowels of the yacht. and it's
like a penguin colony.
Yes. And I think the cruise line industry were taken to task in Alaska because of this, and now they've actually got in place various voluntary rules as well as advanced wastewater treatment now to avoid the discharge of grey water. So that's great on the larger and newer yachts. You now have this, but on the older yachts, the legacy yachts, of course, they are still probably discharging grey water straight out into the anchorage. So the advice there would be to perhaps only do it when you're underway. And then we've got systems available now that can reduce your waste on board, and this is obviously back to that critical factor of, you know, I'm sure from your own experiences at home, you'd be surprised on the regularity that you have to empty your bins from your kitchen. You know, the amount of waste you produce, and you just multiply that multiple times related to the amount of waste that's generated on a yacht. And you can see that there's not an infinite amount of storage space on board a boat to keep it. So whatever you can do to minimize it is beneficial. So now we have systems that can, for example, dehydrate food waste. So reduce that waste from by a factor of about 10 times. We have now glass crushers that, instead of crushing the glass into sharp little shards and reducing the volume, it will now convert it into a sand, which is completely safe to handle. We've got some new innovations which, instead of incinerating waste, you can now put into these systems food waste, oily rags, paper, plastic, and it will use that feedstock as the energy to convert that waste into what's called a biochar. And again, significantly reducing the amount of waste that you have to carry on board. So there's lots of great products now, just on the waste side alone, that can reduce the environmental impact.
And I'm conscious that we're running in towards lunchtime. So Ashley, kind of just as a final question, this panel's entitled Leave No Trace. Do you think there is a realistic chance in the future that we might be able to visit these destinations and have a sustainable future for expedition travel? It's a big question to end on, I apologise.
Well, if I could answer that question, I'd be smarter than everyone in this room, wouldn't I? But what I'd say is I think the industry, the super yacht industry, the mega yacht industry needs to look at how IATO and IECO is doing it. They were created 30 years ago by competitors, and those competitors realized that they needed to protect Antarctica. They started as naturalists. So as naturalists, you want to protect the environment and you want to educate people. And so what I would say is this industry needs to, for it to continue, they need to get together and say, okay, we're going to do what EOS, what Cookson, what Polaris, who are members of IATO, are doing, what Arxen's doing, and challenge their clients to say, okay, give us 10% of your time on the yacht, not with you on board or with you on board, and let scientists take the vessel. Use it for something like Yacht Aid Global, where you're making a positive difference. And if you can imagine all these yachts out here, all the yachts in the world, 5%, 10% of their time being given for philanthropic, not just the few that Rob pointed out are doing philanthropy, but the industry as a whole, challenge their clients to do that. It's a massive asset. And we can justify I went to Greenland with my husband on our 10-meter yacht 2 years ago. I burnt 40 liters of fuel. That's not going to happen anymore. You guys are exploring in 50 meters and 70 meters. But how can you explore but use that asset for the benefit of science and for the benefit of communities? And I think the challenge is an industry, get together, stop being competitors, and challenge your clients to do that as an industry as a whole.
That's hopefully a positive challenge to end on before lunch. Before we do head for lunch, does anyone have any questions for any of the panelists?
Thank you very much for your very interesting presentation. You were talking about, especially you, Captain, about the fact that yacht owners could participate, indeed, from a philanthropic point of view, to science by giving 5 or 10% of the time to scientists. Is there already some incentives for that purpose made? And is there also the industrial world participate in such way to do, like, for instance, super tankers crossing the world with gas and oil proposed to host scientists and get some data information and scientific research?
Maybe that needs to be expanded from, yachts for science to vessels for science, I guess, is the best way of putting it.
At the moment, we're only really dealing with the super yacht market. We could expand this to every boat in the ocean, from a tender to a super yacht. You know, there's so many possibilities. And the concept was only really conceived few months before lockdown, so it's still a bit in its infancy. We have a collection of 11 marine biologists all looking for vessels at the moment. We're just about to open it up and find more marine biologists. They go through a very strict criteria of having their projects approved by Necton. So it means they all have funding, they all have ongoing purposes, and that they link with local communities so that we don't send super yachts to areas of the world that might be a little bit third world, take all our research back to the Western world and not share it with the community that we're doing the research with, which is really vital. The biggest problem we've got is we need more boats. And the boats that we have that are interested are always in the wrong part of the world. And they move around. So if you could stop moving around, follow the scientists, and stay local, that would really help. More boats is what we really need.
I would just say the incentive to the owner is really educational. You know, people are taking their grandkids. We had on this expedition in January, we had three kids age 15. We had to actually not take the helicopter off because one of them was doing an exam online, a maths exam. But we're inquisitive people as a species. We want to learn. So the incentive is, if you bring a scientist on board, you're going to learn a lot more about the environment that you're in. The incentive is not that you can now pick up a penguin and cuddle it, because the scientist has the permit to do that, not you. You're still a tourist. You wouldn't want to pick one up anyways. It's going to flap its flippers at you and probably eject some krills on you.
Well, a great discussion and much to think about. I mean, who wouldn't want to go on a trip with Ashley Perrin and a penguinologist? Just saying, well, hands up for that one. I mean, also, I liked what you said, Malcolm. It's a really exciting time, actually, and there's massive amount of opportunities and things are moving really quickly. And, you know, I think you were right, Mark. We're not going to have to necessarily push our clients. They're going to push us. We need to be ahead of the curve. This is accelerating quickly, and our clients are going to ask a lot of questions of the industry. So on that note.
Thank you for listening to this week's Boat Briefing, which was mixed and produced by Grace Nielsen and is a production of Boat International Media. Don't forget to like and subscribe. There will be another pre-recorded podcast next week, and we will be back to catch up on all the latest news from the superyacht world on January the 7th.